This question is very important and very interesting as well. And it has many aspects. Number one, the same question has been asked of me from a completely different angle. Some people wanted to know that other people than religious have been persecuted and prospered in the world. Other isms and movements. So what is the criteria for truth then? What is the distinctive mark of religious truth as against the truth of a secular nature? Now you are asking it differently. Within the realm of religion, you want to ascertain which are the signs of truth, while apparently there is a similarity of situation between two sects. For instance, let's define that by calling them Baha'is. There are Baha'is in the world who are being persecuted, and so are Ahmadis. So why do we say that we have been persecuted for the sake of Allah and Allah would look after us and this is a sign of truth? Why shouldn't Baha'i make the same claim and run away with it? That is the question perhaps, or anything which applies to a similar situation. So let's just find out the nature of the claim. And the nature of the claim also calls into mind the claimant and his personality and his character. Just the single factor of persecution is not enough to prove anything, because as I have mentioned earlier, this is a factor which is present and common between religious and secular both. So by itself it is not a distinctive feature. People have been persecuted for their crimes. People have been persecuted against their organized effort to capture some societies, and for other secular reasons, for political reasons and so on and so forth. So just the factor of persecution cannot decide. Now the claim also cannot decide alone. The point is what the claim is, number one. Number two, the constancy of the claimant. Whether he stood firm in his claim or wavered and was shaken after the persecution or under the influence of persecution. And thirdly, what is the outcome of that struggle against odds? These three factors put together would decide to some extent. Now in case, for instance, of Baha'is as compared to Ahmadis, one thing is very obvious, that the claim, the founder of first it was Babis and then Baha'is, the claim that was made has been wavering and at times has been taken back and has been changed completely. So that is something which does not indicate that's the source of origin to be Allah. Because Allah does not falter under the influence of persecution and does not permit His prophets or His messengers to change their claims. For instance, Ahadra sallallahu alayhi wa sallam has been categorically told that if you budge an inch or make the slightest diversion from your course, Allah will abandon you and you will be totally destroyed. You will have no place to step on. This is the Holy Quran's claim, giving a warning to Ahl Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. Not that there was a possibility of having ever done it, but only to emphasize in principle that Allah's prophets never budge an inch and they never falter in their claims. Moreover, they do not change their claims to suit the situation, to make the claims more popular. The fact is that their claims always remain to be the bitterest and challenging to the society. Once they make a claim and an opposition starts, their second claim is always more bitter and more pronounced in the same direction of offending others. While there are others who do not follow this line, once a claim is rejected and they are persecuted, they find new societies and change their claim to suit the new societies and make new measurements, with the result that they are after the public pulse, which way it's the public beat, and they want to measure the rhythm of the public intentions. And for instance, like politicians, they have their fingers on the pulses of the people, and if they have made a wrong claim, then they rectify it to suit the people. Now, I'll explain first the first part, then I'll compare it with the second similar situation. Hazrat sallallahu alaihi wasallam made a claim to address the Meccans to begin with. Apparently from the Holy Quran it seems that he came to threaten, to warn Ummul Qura wa man hawlaha, the people of Mecca and those who were around. But even before that, we read it mentioned, Anzir ashirataka wal aqrabin. Anzir ashirataka al aqrabin. You warn your next of kin and close relations. Ashirataka al aqrabin. So the Orientalists have picked it up. They say that he is inventing claims, because the first claim is narrow and shorter, the second becomes wider, and he is progressive. And when he goes to Medina, he begins to address the Ahle Kitab as well, the Jews and the Christians. And in the end, he becomes the prophet of the whole world. So it is just a psychological development that we observe in him. This is their claim. But from the criterion which I have put forward, this is not a proof of his falsehood. This is the strongest proof of his truth. Because if you study human nature more minutely and acutely, you will find that their inference is totally wrong. If a claimant makes a small claim, and then he is well received and becomes popular, it is quite natural for him to step forward in the same direction and widen the claim. And if that claim is also accepted with pleasure and open arms, then naturally he should think, why not a few steps further? But if after making the first small claim, he is beaten thoroughly and thrashed and treated so ill that a man of smaller stature may have committed suicide in such situations, then psychology demands that if it's a false man, he should not go ahead and make a more offending claim to the rest of the world and broaden the circle of his own enemies by widening his claim. So here, this is the situation. In the case of a true prophet, this always is the situation. And in case of Hazrat Muhammad Mustafa sallallahu alaihi wasallam, this situation is highly pronounced. That what Meccans did to him did not frustrate him. It should have frustrated. But he widened his claim, and what the own family members. You know what happened when he called them to a feast and told them what his claim was and why he had called them, because Allah had told him, Anzir ashirataka al aqrabin. So they all got up and became very furious, and Abu Lahab insulted him in very strong terms and said, what is this nonsense? So they ate his food and ran away calling him bad names. So after that, to address Mecca and then Mahoman Holaha, and then to go to Medina, and instead of making them friends, to turn them into enemies as well. And then, as if it were not enough to make the whole world his enemies, this is not possible if the claimant was a false claimant. So, in case of Ahmadiyyat, this is exactly the situation. Hazrat Masih Maud alayhi salatu wasalam never made a popular claim throughout his life. Never made a compromise. For instance, each claim he made was bitter and it widened the sphere of his enemies. There is not a single claim which won him friends. For instance, he first claimed to be a Mamur for the Muslims, a Mahdi. And you know how bitterly they opposed him. Then he, instead of eating his words, retrieving what he had said, he went forward and said, all right, if the Muslims were not enough enemies, why not turn the great British Empire into an enemy and claim that the only son of your God is dead and I am Messiah. That was the bitterest claim that one could ever make or think of in the great British Empire, which went for converting India en masse. That was their policy. They were spending billions of rupees at that time to win over India. So that was the claim. And now two enemies have been made. Then he considers, all right, what about Sikhs? They are majority around Qadian and so on. So why not turn them into enemies? So he claimed that you have no religion at all. All you have is Islam. And the founder, which you call a guru or a founder of a new religion, was just a convert from Khatris to a Muslim. That inflamed Sikhs very much. And they were the strongest community around Qadian. The largest single religion in India, which was the most powerful as well, was Hinduism. So he was not fully satisfied with that. He said, all right, let's turn them into enemies as well. The world is not, this is not enough for me. So he claimed made twofold claims to antagonize both the important sects of Hindus. Number one, Arya Samajis. They were most volatile and militant Hindus. In Punjab particularly, they were the strongest militants of any religious followers. And he claimed that you say that God is one and this is Hinduism. Aryans are those who claimed who believed in the unity of God and claimed that this was Hinduism. So he proved them to be false. He said, you are thieves. You have taken the concept of unity of God from the Holy Quran, while the Vedas are full of filth and pantheism and idolatry and all these things. And you say that Hinduism believes in monotheism. This is totally wrong. And he challenged Lekhra. He was one of the leaders of Arya Samaj. And he was murdered as prophesied by him. So that was his claim, not to win over a strong party from among the people, but to further antagonize. As far as the other Hindus were concerned, he went after them like anything. He said, look here, you believe, you attack Islam for permitting four wives, while you permit 11 husbands to a wife. By preaching yoga and this and that. And his attack on Hinduism, on all aspects, their concept of coexistence of God with creation and all that, is so strong that those who read his first book, Brahine Ahmadiyya, noticed from there that there was a rising star who is going to defend Islam on all directions. But later on, when he made the claims, then he went into open debates with strong Hindu leaders on these issues. And many books are written on this issue. So the whole of India was inflamed against him. Not at the time of Brahine Ahmadiyya. Not a single voice was raised against him at that time. But when he started making claims, then there was not a single denomination of human beings you can conceive whom he had not turned against him. Through a progressive chain of claims, which went in the direction of creating hostility, not winning friends. This is the important feature, as I have explained in the first instance. In the case of Baha'ism, if that is the direction, then one should suspect that they are also right. But this is absolutely a different thing, story with them. First, they claim that Baha'u'llah, Bab claims that I am the door through which the new reformer would appear. I just announce the coming of the new reformer. Then he started the claim that I am the God manifest, making this claim. Then when he was opposed, he took back that claim at different places and said, no, this was not my claim. My claim is that. Then Baha'is claimed that they are a part of Islam for a while. When they were treated ill at the hands of the then government of Iran and extern, then they openly claimed that they were messiahs not for the Muslims, but the messiah of Christians outside Islam, and they had come to amend Islam. And later on, their concept of messiahhood was a compromise between Christianity and Islam. This is why they became popular in the Christian world. They started supporting the Christian belief and tried to win friends there. So only if you study the history of varying claims by Baha'u'llah and by Bab and Baha'u'llah and the subsequent followers, that would prove that they are not consistent in their claims. They keep on varying. So that is one way of studying whether the phenomena is similar to the phenomena of prophethood that has been unfolded to us through ages past, or it differs in fundamentals. In this case, we can prove, and I have in fact books prepared. Have they come on Baha'ism? Chaudhary Naam Maulvi. No. Sadruddin Sahab's books. I think they have come. Afzal Sahab also from Iran also helped me in this. So this is very important. Kyunji, aayi hai ki nahi kitabe abhi tak? Acha. You then write to him, send them immediately. We need them to be published immediately. This confusion must be removed, that Baha'is are similar to us. They are not at all. They are fundamentally different. And they are not different only to Masih Maud alayhi salam's claims, but they are different to this particular phenomena. Prophethood has a particular phenomena. There is no going back, no faltering. It has a direction and a set direction, and every opposition further strengthens the claim, and there is total lack of respect for the public opinion. But in Baha'ism, exactly the opposite is witnessed. But that I don't remember verbatim, so I can... what I was thinking was that Ahmadiyya views on Baha'ism should be widely published nowadays, so that people may not confuse them with us, particularly the Iranians. Because a section of mullahs are now propagating that we are like Baha'is. We are not at all like Baha'is. Now, another important factor is very important. These are just academic studies, and everybody cannot enter into academic studies. There must be some open, clear sign from Allah which we can present, which makes distinction between one from the other. That is, Allah's behavior to those who persecute His dear ones. Allah's treatment to those who persecute His people. In case of true prophets, Allah's punishment is very severe and very strong and visible and noticeable to those who continue to persecute the true followers of Allah's path. And not only that, it is foretold. In each case, there is a prophecy covering that treatment which would be meted out by Allah to those people. And apparently, there is no reason why this should happen. Because in worldly persecutions and in case of persecutions of false claimants, this does not happen. This is exactly the situation with Iranians, now with Baha'is. The persecutors of Baha'is were never punished. They flourished, they succeeded in curbing them, they succeeded in checking them out, and they did whatever they wanted to do without any punishment from Allah, which could tell very prominently and visibly that Allah shows His wrath to those who persecute His people. And there was no prophecy either. In case of Ahmadiyya, not only there are fundamental prophecies by Hazrat Masih Maud alayhi salatu wasalam, but it's a so widespread phenomena, so widely experienced phenomena that even there are Ahmadis individually who are persecuted, and Allah tells them that I'll do this to your enemies. And it so happens. In each Ahmadi family, there would be instances where one of their forefathers who became Ahmadi saw some signs of Allah and His closeness and nearness. This is a phenomena totally lacking in cases of false claimants. For instance, I'll quote the Shahadat of Hazrat Sardar Abdul Latif Shaheed. Now, so many people are murdered every day, much more in number than those who follow Allah and accept His messengers. As far as the persecution, the intensity and amount of persecution is concerned, in reality, those who are secular, who have no friend in God, they are murdered en masse and nobody takes notice of them. But the religious people become pronounced because Allah has an eye on them, and they're always, their persecution becomes much more pronounced than the others. But anyway, that's not the point of discussion. The point is that while thousands or sometimes hundreds of thousands of people are murdered and persecuted, nobody is told by Allah that this is what I'm going to do to your persecutors. Nobody makes such claims, and that does not happen either. In case of this first nature of persecution, that is religious, truly religious persecution, the phenomena is fundamentally different. There are thousands of cases in 74 where Ahmadis were told that Allah's aid would come to them. And it came to them. And Ahmadis were told that their enemies would be punished, and their enemies were punished. And in such manners that it was, for a common neutral observer, it was impossible to discredit that and say it may have happened accidentally. There was no question of accidents involved. It happened systematically. And I have got a collection of such cases certified by non-Ahmadis. I think if you write to Waqf-e Jadeed, I think it must be lying there, that file. I couldn't get all the cases, but maybe there are hundreds where I tried to get it certified by the local people that these were the circumstances in which Ahmadis were treated. This was the fate of those who did it. And the fate was so similar in nature and sometimes so outstanding and rare that it was the local people themselves who felt this was because of that. For instance, in Montgomery, which is your district, there was a family, a small, not a family, I think one single man who was sleeping in the mosque when the enemies attacked the mosque, and he rolled him in the saf, that, what do you call that saf in English?
Mat.
Mat, is straw mat. Yes. And try to put him, to put fire. In fact, they put the mat on fire, and they thought he would be burnt alive or strangled. So after a while they left, but you know how the fire works in sheets, wrapped up sheets. It goes along the sheets. So apparently it was burning, and although he was blistered very severely, but when they left he was still alive. The inner sheet had not yet caught the fire. So he survived with the grace of Allah and went out. Now after a month from this, there was an accident of a bus in which it was reported that no people died of accident. 9 people of a single family got burnt in the accident because of the petrol which caught fire, and they all belonged to the single family, and that was the family which was responsible for this. These men were, they belonged to a single family who tried to put him on fire, to burn him alive. And the report of accident, when I read, I was surprised. I didn't know that this was a family. I sent someone, I said, go and investigate. They must be the same people, because this news is very strange. It does not normally happen that there is a bus accident, nobody gets killed, but 9 people get burnt, and burnt to death, and they are all of the same family. So then testimony came that the elder members of this family were responsible for that effort, and it was their family which was burnt alive. So there are so many such cases. In case of Hazrat Abdul Latif Shaheed, now I'll quote a very interesting incident. When he was taken to be stoned, half buried in soil, that was a time when a British engineer, chief engineer at that time, was working in Kabul. Now, after that period of Habibullah, he wrote a book under the title of An Absolute Amir. That was the title, Under an Absolute Amir. So that was just a secular study, historical study of how absolute he was and what happened during his lifetime and this and that. He quotes now, and I'll the words will be mine, but this is exactly what he has written. He says, during the lifetime of that Amir, it so happened that there was a great mullah who was the court mullah and highly respected man. He went to India and accepted a claimant who called himself a Mahdi and Messiah and this and that. And although he knew that he would be severely punished, he came back and from the government side, debate was organized between him and the top mullahs, and they said, this is a long story, very interesting, but I cut it short. We reached the end. He said, what he tells, which is very significant and which relates to this discussion, is this, that he says that before he was to be stoned, he told the people around that, I know one thing, Allah has told me, that a great calamity is going to befall you, and that will happen very soon. So I'm not afraid for myself, but I'm afraid for you. You will be terribly punished by Allah. So nobody paid heed to this, but he said that the first strange thing that happened was that half an hour after his stoning, a strange let's say, dust storm, like a typhoon, appeared, which was totally red in color, and this was no season for dust storms. Never in the history of Kabul, a storm had appeared during that season, and then of that severity, and for it to be colored red, that was also something which aided the people to to believe in the words of that mullah, who uses the word mullah. And they started talking. And they said, that mullah must be right, he must have been a godly person, and this is the first sign that Allah has shown us. So he said, it was so strong a rumor that in the palace, people shook with fear. And they realized that this was a great blunder they had committed. Within 7 days, according to his report, he was a neutral observer, he doesn't know Ahmadiyyat, even he misquotes Ahmadiyyat. He said, within 7 days, a cholera broke out, which was very severe in nature, and thousands of people began dying, and with great torturous death. That cholera was so painful that, there are certain choleras in which griping is very severe, and the person dies in extreme anguish. So he said, that was the nature of cholera. So the doors of the palace were closed, and nothing could enter the palace from then on. He says, the one person responsible for the death of that mullah was Nasrullah Khan, the brother of Habibullah Khan, who was the governor of Kabul. Habibullah all the time sided with him, and Nasrullah Khan it was who insisted that he must be put to death like this. He says, even he was so strong in his hostility that in the debate, 10 mullahs out of 12 who was opposing him, ultimately gave in and agreed with him and said, the Holy Quran and Sunnah is with the side of this mullah, the Hazrat Abdul Latif Shaheed. And only 2 mullahs didn't admit. Yet Nasrullah Khan said, I'll follow the verdict of 2 mullahs and not of the 10. So he showed that that was the extent of his narrow-mindedness and bigotry and his hostility to Abdul Latif Shaheed. So he said he was the most terrified. He said punishment came his way in a manner which he could not conceive. He had married a wife whom he loved madly. And despite total blockade of things coming in from edible particularly, he said even the persons were not allowed to enter the palace. His wife suffered from that cholera and died in extreme agony and anguish before his eyes. That turned him mad. And after that, he was only seen, never in the affairs of the state, he was only seen standing the whole night crying, and he had lost his mental balance. So this is what is quoted by a completely neutral observer who has no idea what Ahmadiyyat is and what Ahmadiyya claims are. And he is not a prophet who is stoned. He is one of the martyrs. The greatest, of course, as we believe, but he didn't know it. So he claims that Allah has told me that this would happen, and it so happens, and in such an extraordinary manner that even a neutral observer who doesn't believe in his religion, he is deeply impressed and writes this story in his book, while his story is on different things. Now his book relates to different subjects, not directly concerned with this. So that is what I mean. This is an illustration that the phenomena of truth unfolded by prophets is not a very small phenomena which is circled by in a narrow field. It is a widespread phenomena then. It becomes the property of every member of the community. I mean, this is scientific, an experience which is shared by hundreds of thousands of people from then on. This is totally lacking in the case of Baha'is. They don't even claim it. They don't know that this is a phenomenon in existence. So, a resemblance somewhere does not speak entirely upon a subject. There are many resemblances between truth and falsehood as well. It is for one to analyze it and make criterion of the religious history first. Analyze that history, understand the nature, and then apply the apparently two conflicting situations who claim the same thing but are in conflict with each other. They should be put to the touchstone of religious history And then you should get your answer whether this claimant is right or that claimant is right.
I have a question.